سيوني
thank you.
And good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and yes, the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, my guest will be, recorded from ReaderCon earlier this year, John Clute. We'll tell you more about him, and Dan Persons has a review, and oh yeah, got to talk again about puppies.
Director Jonas Alexander Armby isn't subtle about his agenda in the new film When Animals Dream. In the opening, the teenage protagonist Marie, played by Sonia Sewell, is undergoing a distinctly uncomfortable medical exam after an odd blemish has spontaneously appeared on her chest. The doctor, a man, gropes her face, closely examines her nails, pulls apart her lips to look at her gums, all with a cold, professional detachment. There's nothing about the scene, muted though it may be, that doesn't figuratively scream subjugation. And that's only emphasized when we meet Marie's mother, a woman sedated into a comatose state, and discover that the reason for the drugging is because she can shape-shift. The term werewolf is not mentioned, but strongly implied. Clearly, whatever she can become is bestial and dangerous. Well, like mother, like daughter, and it turns out that as Marie discovers her blemish sprouting coarse, dark hair, her father, and apparently the entire small fishing village where she lives, are all too eager to have her meet her own date with the syringe. The metaphor is not especially new, but not unwelcome either. The exploration of how our animal selves can come into conflict with society's strictures, or more severely, oppression, is a powerful one, and there still is too much in many cultures that casts women as, if not second-class citizens, then at least not deserving of 100% of a man's hourly wage. Unfortunately, Armby seems to feel that having laid down his themes, his work is over. In fact, Armby's treatment of this story often feels as monochromatic as his admittedly attractive photography. The town seems to have all of 25 inhabitants, all of whom work at the fish processing plant that's just hired Marie, and the persecution the budding lycanthrope experiences there seems to all be, in some way or another, fish-based to an almost comical extent. The story, while not lacking an incident, isn't especially complex, and here I have to note that my screening copy lacked closing credits, so I am not sure the film was supposed to end as anticlimactically as it did, but given that it did represent a kind of endpoint, I'm going to presume that I got everything. I have to point this out, though, speaking of fish-based persecution. Near the beginning of the film, Marie antagonizes one of her more boneheaded co-workers. Not long after, she's attacked in the locker room by two masked men, who force her to her knees and, as one of the men stands before her, begins saying things like, "Look what I've got for you." The camera then angles to reveal the man is actually holding a fish, which he slaps Marie's face with. rape scenes are loaded to begin with, and it takes a better filmmaker than Mr. Arnby to think he can gain absolution by going, see? Kidding. A moment like this wouldn't be out of place given when animals, dreams, themes. But in my world, you either commit and be prepared for the consequences both within your story and from the audience, or you don't entertain the notion to begin with. When Animals Dream doesn't have anywhere near the furious energy of the much more lively and incendiary werewolf film Ginger Snaps, there's something to be said for its muted tone and restrained performances, and both the makeup and digital effects, limited as they are nicely done. But director Arnby needed to find more to his story than just declaring that the patriarchy is bad. We already understand that. Well, the men's rights tools don't, but the rest of us do, and we don't need to be told it again. When Animals Dream is a prelude to the revolution, and an attractive one, but we've already been engaged at the front for years, and it needed to take that into consideration. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, we are archiving these reviews over at my Mighty Movie Podcast website, so check out what you missed by going to mightymoviepodcast.com. Dan Persons Movie Review.
Okay, you know, this thing, this player is set to repeat. I don't know why whoever uses it sets it that way, but they do. When you expect the same, next thing to start playing. But in this case, the next thing to start playing is me. Good morning, I am Jim Freund. This is Hour of the Wolf. And last week on the program, I ended with a rant that ended up really ranting because I realized I was running out of time. And that's probably a good thing because my rant, I mean, as it was, I went quite over the edge in a couple of ways. I hope you all enjoyed it. I know I did. But there needed to be a little bit more perspective. What we are talking about are the famed, now famed, I mean, you know, when you're covered in the New York Times and major media all over the world, and even the so-called personality, Breitbart, sides with the people that basically tried to take over the Hugo Awards. And when Losing said, you see, this is how they are. So let me just recap a little bit of it. There's two groups that were trying to, that did successfully take over the nominations for the popularity contest. That is the Hugo Award. Now, you've heard of that probably. You see it on book covers. Winner of the Hugo Award. And then there's also the Nebula Award. The Nebula Award is voted upon by the Science Fiction Writers of America. It is a peer award. Maybe, I don't know, somewhere between 500 and 700 people vote for the Nebula, if that much. Then there are other awards. There's the Shirley Jackson Award and the Sideways Award for Alternate History, and the Cordwainer Smith Award for Good Writers Unjustly Forgotten, so on and so forth. Most of these, including the World Fantasy Award, which is a major one, are voted upon by a jury, and usually no more than seven people, sometimes as few as three. But the Hugo Award can be gamed. It has been before, but not to the extent it had been this year. There was a group that 3 years ago, bemoaning the fact that science fiction had moved away from rocket jockey space opera fiction and was more socially oriented and being done by what they call social justice warriors, a phrase that if it was applied to me, I don't think I would totally object. And they have for 3 years running been making their recommendations. That's fine. Anybody wants to make recommendations on what the Hugos or the Nebulas should be, that's great. I refrain from doing it because I'm not just a podcast. I'm not just a zine. I'm media. I'm actual New York broadcast media. And that can hold a certain amount of power, no matter how few listeners there may be at certain hours on WBAI at this time. Nevertheless, it has, it's rebroadcast, it's podcast, it's there. It carries weight, and I don't think that media users should abuse that. Well, it was abused, and badly. Not so much by the sad puppies, but by a group calling itself the Rabid Puppies, which are run by a fellow named Theodore Beale, who tried unsuccessfully a few years ago to run for the president of the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America. He was totally cast out and has been upset about that since. And he started this group, sort of taking up the gauntlet that the sad puppies had thrown out and became the angry puppies. And together I call them the rabid puppies. Now, this one, not horribly meaning group, but slightly misguided in my opinion, teamed up with the angry puppies to form the rabid puppies. And the rabid puppies said, "You will vote this way and no other way. You will do what I say." And, you know, with the cult of personality that this guy who now calls himself Vox Day, and he runs a publishing company, and everybody who he was nominating was basically from that publishing company, Castilia Publishing, to the point where in the short story category, three of the stories were by the same single person, who, by the way, isn't that bad a writer, but he sort of, as far as I'm concerned, at a certain point, he went from being an atheist to being a devout religious person. And at that point, his writing sort of went off the deep end, so far as I'm concerned. But he's not a bad writer. Having said that, this is a fellow named John C. Wright, Wright with a W. So, with only, you know, it took only something like 40 votes to basically get a nomination in there. There weren't that many people voting on nominees. And by the time the awards came out, a record number of people voted. Over 10,000. I think the previous high had been something like 8,000. And of those 8,000 members, maybe 3,000 voted this year. 10,000 people joined the Worldcon. All you have to do is pay your money. It's about $40. And record numbers voted. I don't have the exact number in front of me. And the awards came out pretty well, but what was sad were the number of no awards that were done. You see, they use what's called an Australian ballot. You don't say, "I vote for this." What you say is number one, number two, number three, all the way to number five, and then you can also include no award. People were making jokes throughout the event on Twitter and places like that saying, "Who's Noah Ward?" And at any rate, it's sad because there were good people who deserved to be nominated who couldn't be heard. But so let me just run down the winners. The John W. Campbell Award for New Writer, which is not technically a Hugo Award. This is sponsored by Dell Magazines, but they've been doing it for quite a while. Is Wesley Chu, C-H-U. and Best Fan Artist, Elizabeth Leggett, Best Fan Writer, Laura J. Mixon, Best Fan Cast, as opposed to, like a professional podcast, Galactic Suburbia Podcast. Now, note that there's nothing like Best Broadcast, because there isn't enough, of what I do to go around. I can't even be nominated in any kind of category. There's no place for 40-plus years of doing this stuff, either in the Nebulas or the Hugos, where a radio program about science fiction could even be nominated. So if anybody should go sniffle, it might be me, except for one thing, and we're about to get to that. The best fanzine was Journey Planet, but the best semi-pro zine was Lightspeed Magazine. Thank you, thank you. Second year in a row. If you go to lightspeedmagazine.com and listen to the podcast, you can read, there are 8 stories a month. 4 of those stories are turned into podcasts. I am the audio editor, post-production editor is what they actually call it, of those podcasts. And yes, I am your host. So, and I got shouted out from on stage. I missed it again. I missed it last year when I was in England, and I missed it this year. I sort of tuned in on live stream. It is, however, now apparently available for streaming on live stream. I haven't seen it yet. One of the winners, I'm very grateful, sent me a shaky cam of the iPhone, but it was professionally filmed. So I got called out, and I'm very pleased about that. I'm not a winner, but close to it. Thank you. John Joseph Adams, who's been on the show several times, is the editor. Stefan Rudnicki is the producer of the podcast. Rich Horton, Wendy Wagner, and Christy Yant are the people who actually put it together. The best pro artist was Judy Dillon. Best dramatic presentation short form was an episode of Orphan Black, which, while I haven't seen it, that pleases me. Best dramatic presentation long form was Guardians of the Galaxy, and I think there might have been a better science fiction movie last year, but I'm not sure what it was. And anyhow, this is a popularity award, and so fine. Best graphic story was Ms. Marvel number 1, No Normal. The best novelette, The Day the World Turned Upside Down by Thomas Olde Hoyvelt, with Lisa Belt being the translator. A translator. A foreign language story initially turned into English. Published live. Oh, that's us again, Lightspeed Magazine. Yay. And we did the podcast of that as well, so you can hear on that. And then the best novel, and this is the big news, and this one, they actually had it announced from the International Space Station, The Three-Body Problem by Cixin Liu, spelled C-I-X-I-N Liu, and Ken Liu was the translator. And again, a Chinese story, not Chinese-American, Chinese, translated by a Chinese-American, Ken Liu, who's been on this show and will probably be on very shortly, because he's another one of the people who I interviewed at ReaderCon for, and this is the second time. So we're going to hear that very soon. And The Three-Body Problem is a wonderful novel, and I got to work on the first third of that novel as an audiobook, so that was very pleasing. But here's the sad story. Best novella, short story, related work, editor short form, and editor long form all got no awards. And that's a shame, because there were good people who were deserving of an award, especially in one of the categories. It was all these people from this one right-wing publishing house, et cetera, et cetera. In one case, the same person nominated 3 times. Might this person have been nominated without somebody basically stuffing the ballot? It's possible, but doubtful. Very doubtful. So when these people, the puppies, lost, their leader has people going out saying, oh, that's the SJWs for you, all the lefty social justice warriors, et cetera, et cetera. And we have buried the Hugo Award. Well, no, they haven't. All they've, and then, here is my favorite statement of all. All they've done is turn it into a popularity contest. Well, duh. The Hugo Awards are a popularity contest. What did you think they were? They've always been that, and they will continue to be that. But now, way many more people are going to be involved in the nominating process, so the ballot can't be stuffed again. So, and they're also going to try to make some kind of changes, I don't know what they are, to the Worldcon rules that will take effect in like 2 years. But that's neither here nor there. So I thought I would report on that. What does this come away with? Go to Lightspeed Magazine and read or listen to The Day the World Turned Upside Down, and which was in April of last year, April 2014. And get yourself a copy of The Three Body Problem by Cixin Liu, again, Cixin Liu. It's a wonderful book. It's the beginning of a series, and I think you'll like it. So there's a little more even-handed and background version of the rant that I had last week. But really, it was sort of sad to see what this all came up to, or down to, with the politicization of the awards. So, a little bit of music, and then an interview with John Clute. Talk about social justice warriors. This is them, or should I say, us. Unfortunately, I'm also on the side of math, and while I love this version of Natalie Merchant from her album The House Carpenter's Daughter doing Which Side Are You On, if we are to hear the entire John Clute interview, we can't play the whole thing, but I did need to get that out. John Clute, I think who he is will become self-evident in the interview that we are about to hear. Very important was that he put out the print edition of the Science Fiction Encyclopedia and the Encyclopedia of Fantasy as well. And these have now turned into online properties, which you can freely access, and he will tell you how to do that. But Clute is also one of the great collectors of science fiction books. He has a collection that is to be envied of some 11,000 titles. And so, pleased to announce, and this is an announcement as of this week, the Telluride Institute is extremely pleased to announce the acquisition of the Clute Science Fiction Library at Telluride collection, which contains approximately 11,000 titles comprising important books in the field, almost all of them first editions. This collection will act as a resource library for writers, scholars, and students. It will best serve as the focus for an annual mountain colloquy among some of science fiction's best minds. That's if you can get to Telluride, I suppose. John Clute is a multiple Hugo Award winner and World Fantasy Award winner and visiting fellow at Anglia Ruskin University in Cambridge, England. He is perhaps known for the editorship of the Encyclopedia of Science Fiction and as an illustrious and prolific reviewer and essayist. He has profoundly influenced science fiction writing in his time. The SFE, that's the encyclopedia, is now almost 5 million words in length, of which John Clute's own contribution exceeds 2 million words. So we have a little bit more information about that, but let's get to the interview. This, because it's a little over an hour, and it's now 2 minutes shy of 2 o'clock in New York City. Over WBAI New York and WBAI.org. And I have an announcement to make. Okay, September 8th. Very simple. Go nowhere else. Head over to 388 Atlantic Avenue where WBAI is located, but never mind that. You're not coming up to WBAI. You're going into the Brooklyn Commons Cafe, the ground floor of the building, where WBAI resides, and we will be beginning our silver anniversary season, our 25th season of the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. And our readers are going to be Rajan Khanna and Michael Swanwick. Well, this is a good lineup. What can I say? There will be food, there will be raffles, there will be stuff. The admission is free, but we will hawk you for donations because it costs us money. In fact, we're going to be doing a crowdfunding campaign very late this year. And it's available on live stream, which does not let you off the hook if you're within 100 miles of here, okay? Only if you live way, way out is it all right to watch it on live stream. But if you go to ourwolf.com, H-O-U-R-W-O-L-F, you can see some of the dry runs we did of the live stream broadcast. That's an audio buzz, but never mind that. You can hear Sam J. Miller. You can see Sam J. Miller, Samuel R. Delaney, Robert Sherman of Doctor Who fame, and N.K. Jemison, Nora Jemison, and Cherie Renee Thomas all reading. That's three different readings that we did in April. So, we will begin that 25th season on September 8th. Please, please, please show up. Whether or not you can donate, please show up. Okay, having said that, now let's set your Wayback Machine to early July, to Burlington, Massachusetts, to where were we? We were near where they do the coffee klatches, upstairs in Burlington. And speaking with John Clute, whose name, by the way, is C-L-U-T-E.
The first thing I want to do is slate the recording and saying that it's about 11 a.m., give or take, on July 19th in Burlington, Mass., at the last ReaderCon to be in Burlington, Mass., because it'll move to Quincy, Mass., as of next year. And I'm with John Clute, who has probably, what, your third or fourth time on the program over the years.
I remember, I think, three times. Four times may have, as were folded into three.
Yeah, I think that you were at the studio.
Yes.
Three times, and that, similar to now, we did a remote recording, only then it would have been with much heavier equipment.
Back when steam still came out of the manholes in Manhattan.
Steam came out of the recorder, actually. So it has been long enough that we should bring people up to date and go, you know, to the way back, as it were.
Almost 20 years, I think. It's an extraordinary number of years.
It is. It really is.
And both of us are still here.
You are.
Well, there's a really, really good facsimile Jim Freund across the mic from me.
Yeah, it's sort of operating on automatic.
Yeah. The facial recognition is so good. I can tell you, people, Jim Freund version recognized me so fast I thought that he was on speed. It must have been facial recognition.
That would have been
that was a facial
ago.
Recognition software. It must have been.
Yes. So, going back, you have been a writer, critic, I wouldn't say television commentator, but I've seen you on a number of TV shows.
I've been on some television shows. I've not made a serious attempt to become a careerist in that particular endeavor.
Yeah.
I've had some enterprises, minor enterprises with the BBC. But I always found that I was out of my depth with regard to how to, as it were, coordinate a living income and what they were offering and what they wanted me to do.
Yeah,
it was beyond my rank.
It's government work.
I did not have the knack of as it were dancing that dance in particular. Oh, I'm happy to go back.
One of the earliest interviews I did with you is when you were in preparation for the Encyclopedia of Science Fiction third edition, was it? Second edition?
I think it might have been, depending on how long ago it was, it might have been the second edition of the Encyclopedia of Science Fiction, which came out in 1993, or the first edition of the Encyclopedia of Fantasy, which came out in 1997.
Yeah, we did interviews for both then.
So I was then involved in doing what turned out to be the last print version of the Encyclopedia of Science Fiction.
Right.
Which was published in 1993, and we went over it back then, but that's 22 years ago.
Yeah.
And it was 22 years ago.
Yeah.
Vast enterprises, it seemed then. It was 1,400,000 words, one volume, well over 1,000 pages. It was as much as we could do with the research facilities, the brains, the technology, the modus operandi that we had developed. That was our limit.
Right.
In 1993.
And so, bringing us up to date.
Yeah.
That mere 22 years or so since we last spoke.
My agent in the UK has indicated that though he's not exactly making a profit off dealing with us, the file he has on various negotiations and contracts, etc., with the Encyclopedia of Science Fiction is by far his biggest.
Really? Okay.
It has always been complicated.
Yeah.
We've always been in the position of attempting to sign contracts for enterprises which were not quite within the boilerplate. An encyclopedia is usually a house enterprise that one is hired as an employee of the house or as a freelance professional to engage upon. And probably it is an in-house operation, if it's Macmillan or Grolier or whatever. So that there are staff members who come in and out of the picture, creating this or that aspect of the enterprise, doing this or that aspect of fact searching or vetting as to what goes in and what does not go in, so that kind of enterprise is contractable and was expectable in 1990 or so. But what we were doing was, as essentially entrepreneurs, Peter Nichols and myself were the sole proprietors, we engaged ourselves to be the publisher and the writer and the editor and the fact checker. And anything that we did to offload some of the task was on our, as it were, on our purse.
Yeah.
So we were not part of a larger enterprise, but this was exceedingly complicated to contract for. It's also a good description of why the encyclopedia is unusual, because an encyclopedia that is an in-house encyclopedia is likely to adhere to programmatic restraints, protocols, that are required of that house so that this encyclopedia fits into its array of reference works. We stood alone. Eventually, there was an Encyclopedia of Fantasy, which stood alone too, with us siblings, because they were, although not exactly the same editorial team, we used essentially the same ascription system, the same setting conventions, the same structure of responsibility. So it was a very different kind of enterprise as it was written, and the result is different. We maintained, I think, a good record of factual, the default artifact of factual reliability and repeatability. So the fact in page 20, if it appeared again in page 800, it would be the same fact.
Right.
You would recognize the same fact. This we did, I think, pretty well, but we built up from there so that the individual entries in the encyclopedia as a whole gradually became a more unusual entity, a more unusual creature, where there was more opinion allowed, more speculation allowed, always within the frame of that default artifact of repeatable, uniform fact and ascription. So our book was very unusual, and I'm very, very happy at how unusual it is, because nobody else has done it. And as we get close to the present, I think we've found that the particular structure we had invisibly becomes online net friendly. But we can go to that later in a minute if you like. So in 1993, that's what we were doing. And
right.
We talked about that.
Okay.
And in 1997, we probably talked about the Encyclopedia of Fantasy, which was edited by me and John Grant. And it had much of the same structure, but of course it required, because fantasy and science fiction in the 20th century anyway were quite radically dissimilar, it required a change from themes as such, objective, descriptive themes that you could find in the bloody Library of Congress, which destroys all creative thought by putting 5 or 10 themes underneath a particular book so that aspiring adjuncts and their students can, this is obviously about X, so therefore I'll pull this out and talk about it. That kind of thing we were very far removed from. We had to create, however, from instead of themes as described there, which we kind of modified anyway, we had to create motif entries. And the motif entries were much more shape of story entries rather than shape of subject matter entries. So that the Encyclopedia of Fantasy, which is not fantasy, not being an intellectual field or not pretending to be an intellectual field, fantasy required us to describe how it worked. Science fiction, we could assume in 1979 when we started, science fiction works because it works. But fantasy only works if we begin to understand how story works.
Fair enough.
So we continued.
Pardon me.
And then we got into the glories of the 21st century.
Yes.
In, I think it was 2000, the year 2000, I wrote a long argument to the publishers, the then publishers.
Which was?
What it was a very complicated story, which we shouldn't really go
into
at any rate.
So
there's nothing confidential,
that.
But one could be very boring about Captain Bob Maxwell, who nobody knows about in the States, who as it were, vacuumed out all the innards of various publishing companies he owned, including McDonald's, which had published us. So there was there were really complicated transactions that went on that didn't have too much to do with us directly, but by the year 2000, who knows who had bought who. We eventually found that we were negotiating with one or another arm or beloved lieutenant or daughter or satrap of Hachette.
Ah, okay.
And it took 5 years, but eventually we did get a enormously complicated contract for an online encyclopedia, but nobody knew what we meant by that. We had some idea that what you see now was kind of in our minds, an encyclopedia which had, which was identifiably the child of the earlier ones, with an identifiable similarity of understanding and grasp of a large field, but everything could be opened out.
Right.
And once you began to open out, and as long as you did it with logic and rigor, that opening out made things clearer, not just more diffuse.
Right.
So that basic principle governed our first 5 years of beginning to rewrite and to add to this original encyclopedia.
And also allowed for linkage.
What were cross-references in the old one?
Yeah.
Became electronic links.
Yeah, exactly.
That was one of the magic things that we were so lucky with. Our cross-reference system and the electronic links were basically identical.
Yeah.
In terms of how they worked internally.
Wasn't there a CD version?
Well, they don't talk about that too much. That was from the CD-ROM from Grolier, who...
That's where the name stuck in my head.
Tragically, Grolier didn't... They paid us a lot of money. But they paid us a lot of money the company was bipolar. At that stage, it was at the manic stage of a bipolar understanding that CD-ROMs were going to rule the world for the next 100 years.
Yeah. But that was pretty much how everybody thought at that time, although I was already working in the online industry for a few years.
If you were beginning to get some kind of dark premonition that CD-ROMs might not be the final platform for the future.
Yes, because at the time I was a CompuServe whiz-op working for Ziff Davis doing mm-hmm. stuff for them. And I had been on online services since the 80s, early 80s.
You might, on the part of a wise corporation, have been asked a few questions, or someone in your position might have been asked a few questions about just what might happen, what kind of prognostication this particular platform might have. Because it's essentially, inherently, in memory now, of course, a deeply, deeply clunky platform.
Yeah.
Massively slow.
But at that point,
and not really improvable.
We did not... however, foresee the true portability of information at that time. So during this interview, I went to look at a Wikipedia link and a couple of things so far. And that, outside of maybe a logic named Joe by Murray Leinster,
had not been grokked.
Yeah.
It clearly had not been. It was the episteme, the mental set of the culture was still put things into fixed form and then make it pretty easy to access that fixed form. It was not the wave of the future, and they made other mistakes as well. They took our encyclopedia, which had been around for many, many years in one volume or edition or another, and took our names off it, changed its name. In other words, wiped out any kind of goodwill or repurchase impulse, called it the Grolier Multimedia Encyclopedia of Science Fiction. Our names appeared at the bottom of the copyright acknowledgments page at something like 1,000 pages in.
Wow. Yeah.
So our names for what they were worth then, the name of the encyclopedia for what it was worth, they forgot about.
Yeah, they know they just wanted to brand themselves.
And their page was a page down the middle. It was a narrow column where the text would eventually appear if you asked for it. But it was surrounded by bells and whistles.
Yes.
But all of them fixed in place. You know, there are 30 interviews... or 30-second interviews with famous science fiction figures. Okay, that takes a day to look at. Then it's done. And there were things like that. Bells and whistles everywhere. And the description of the encyclopedia was that it had this, and this, and this, and this. And it even has 1,200,000 words.
Mm-hmm.
Which was 2 books short of how many words it had. And hardly the right location for describing the only point that all these bells and whistles exist at all.
Yeah,
use of.
I got an early copy, and it's probably still sitting on a shelf somewhere. And it may still have the plastic on it.
Hey, donate it somewhere. You know, put it in your will. It's a valuable artifact. I don't think very many were sold.
Well, mine was a review copy, certainly.
That was not a sold copy. We've learned that, haven't we?
Yeah.
Review copies are not sold copies, and publishers don't like to give them out anymore.
Oh yeah, no. And on the other hand, I'm actually very happy, very often, just to get galleys and arcs electronically. Then, when I want the book, I buy the book.
I'm too old for that.
You, on the other hand, have one of the more glorious book collections in the world.
It is actually a collection, rather than an accumulation.
Yes, it's curated.
Yeah. And it is self-curated, the way the encyclopedia is, so that it is 7,000 of the covers are now scanned and in the picture gallery for the online encyclopedia.
Yeah.
And it's actually it's cataloged as well on a DOS basis, but DOS is very easy to search.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
And I was able to, in the early 80s, to create the template.
Yeah.
For searchability on a very primitive level, which works absolutely well now.
Yes.
It can be transferred over to whatever kind of medium you want, but it works well. So there was a physical basis for my distaste for electronic editions. I use them, of course, but I think the Hinge book is a work of genius, and I think there is something that one can argue very seriously about the pixelation of our perceptual intellectual world through Kindle, various electronic forms of literature, which radically disengage the experience of reading the page from the experience of knowing where, when, how, and what format that page originally existed. Books exist as a narrative in their physical self, which is a story enabling a narrative. A book that was published in 1948 with a dust jacket by somebody from 1935 who was trying to cope with World War II and new publishers, and with dust jacket copy that never heard of science fiction but longs to have heard of science fiction, and a description of Isaac Asimov or somebody like that before they became well known, and a particular smell, a particular heft. All of these things sound a little fetishistic, but the accumulation of that is not fetish, but contextual knowledge. It's called civilization.
Yeah. And there's also a, which is ironic because one of the people I work with on audiobooks was the narrator of the Will Durant story of Civilization, the whole thing. And that...
Many of us old enough have parents who bought one or two volumes of that with the thought that it might be something that could actually be read. Then, of course, Mortimer Adler's great books of the Western world took over.
Uh-huh.
We have a lot of cultural baggage in the 20th century that we are very, very lucky not to have around.
Some of it, yes, but some of it is... It's lovely going back to some of those old titles, and especially out of print titles that nobody's going to bring back.
Individual into titles, yes.
E-print or whatever.
But even if you have the e-print, I think,
yeah,
and they're very useful, and you use them, there's no reason why it should not be supplemental.
Yes.
Complementary to original iterations with all that complex feelingness and context. We desperately need to hold on to make sticky our memories, our context, the structure of our pasts, because if we don't, they get pixelated.
Including Baird Searles, who did quite a bit on his own, and a wee bit of the audio work from Tony Boucher, Anthony Boucher, who was at our radio station at Pacifica Radio, mostly in the capacity of being a music director, but tried to hold that man down.
Yeah,
so.
That was an unfortunate early death.
Yeah. So as was Barrett's. So, yeah. What I have are 10-inch reel-to-reel recordings of metal on plastic,
right?
Oxide on plastic, and they are not easy to preserve. It is preservable, but to do an hour would cost about $250, and I have thousands of hours.
Right. Is there basically an alternative, which is to copy them into a digitalized form?
Well, this is what I'm talking about. Oh, it would cost
that much to copy them.
It's that much to make a copy into a digital form.
Jesus.
Because the tape was not made to last much more than 20 or 30 years. Acetate just splinters when you look at it.
Of course.
Mylar can stretch. There are some kinds of tape that work, some that don't. And every single piece of tape that I have were edited, so they have splicing tape. That splicing tape is 40, 50 years old. If you blow on the reel, the splicing tape, too hard, the splicing tape will come off. And horribly, the labels all have come off because of their age.
And a 200-year-old book can be read almost the same way it was read 200 years ago.
Yes.
With the same eyes. And with the same paper, because, of course, the paper was relatively permanent before rag became too expensive and pulp paper began to gradually take over in the early, mid-19th century.
Yeah, I'm sure that your newer books are in...
Much more risk. Much greater risk.
Much greater risk.
I don't have very many books of the early 19th century and earlier, 10, 20 books. And they're all in good shape.
Yeah, and
their paper is flexible.
I'm astonished. I watch. I love watching various documentaries of many kinds, and I'll see somebody like Michael Wood, who take a look at a early 20th century book, put on the white gloves and the page turner, and then pick up a 19th century book and just leaf through it.
Exactly.
And I'm going, how can he do that? Wait, this piece of paper that he's looking at right now is 300 years old, and they're just holding it in the air.
Mm-hmm.
The curator
is
just holding it in the air and saying, oh, look here, and pointing and saying, the oil from your fingers. No,
doesn't damage it.
It's amazing. It really is.
Quite astonishing. So that's kind of a subset of a long argument about... You know, I use a word all the time. People make fun of me for using it, but let me just use it. The word is hexiety, and it is a Latin word which means the thingness of things, the context and thingness of things. And if you say it, say it like this, hexiety. Heck, see it, you've got the word. So the hexiety of the world is being radically corrupted and polluted and pockmarked by these revolutions, at the end of which we have something like what you get when you, as it were, as a passenger on an airplane, you go into an airplane terminal and you come out the other end, and you have been digitalized to a certain degree.
Yes.
You have you've been barcoded. In a sense, you have done what characters did in Algis Budrus's Rogue Moon.
Yes.
You come in at one terminal, you go to the other terminal, and that is a copy of the you that went into the first terminal. And what is lost in that copy is what I call, stealing it from Chris Priest's The Prestige, he didn't mean this by that, but he agreed in person, although not in writing, that I could use this. What I call what is lost between one copy and the next, not just the fungibilization or the consumerization or the monetization, I call it the prestige. I think we can call what is lost between you before and you after as the prestige.
Yeah.
It's not something Walter Benjamin uses the term aura, but he's describing a particular description of the nature of the work of art itself. This is a description of a transaction.
Yeah.
And that transaction, that prestige, is like mist. It disappears. We never get it back. Every time we go anywhere in this world today, we are exercising ourselves in matter transmission.
Mm-hmm.
And we are ending up having lost a bit of our prestige.
Yeah.
I think it's a good metaphor.
It's a good metaphor. And a lovely pun.
It's as I say, borrowed, stolen from Chris Priest, but I think rhetorically applicable to every transaction we make, which involves us moving from one place to another, or pushing a button on any machine and having a version of us tell us that we like this or don't like this.
Yeah, you gave it attribution. You didn't steal it.
This was the conversation of wise souls after several beers at night in the middle of England. Yes, exactly. That's what I'm talking about. That gets lost. Those wise conversations.
They really
do. But seriously.
But now we have the NSA, so they'll be kept.
Every preserved book is a book that has not had that particular prestige removed from it. Okay, context, place, publication data, knowledge. That, in a sense, is irradiated by that which could be described as prestige when it's transformed into digital form.
Yeah. There was the first thing I want to do.
Women, whatever it was, 3% max of maybe the greatest classical poet have survived.
Yeah.
So, you know, like we are talking about overwhelming loss.
Yeah.
We're not talking about small decisions that are going to make a moderately serious thing better. I think this is last gasp stuff. And the encyclopedia, in a sense, does not make a strong argument in its entity, in its beingness, in its hexeity, for the arguments I'm making, because it is online now. It doesn't exist in the physical sense.
Yeah.
But that narrative which I was going through, got up to 2005, got a contract going. But after 4 or 5 years, we found out the contract was going anywhere. Basically, we're being frustrated because they didn't know how to do it. We didn't know how to tell them how to do it, and it needed money because the contract had been written without any thought as to the cost of site design, really. I don't think it was written with goodwill and good-heartedness, but it was not written sagaciously.
Yeah.
So we had to go into the wilderness for a little while until Orion Gallants, headed by Malcolm Edwards, who had always had a hand in and was interested in the encyclopedia, okayed a new contract which incorporated a site design for the online presentation that David Langford, my partner, and who is without what David Langford has done with all of this material single-handedly, essentially, there would be no encyclopedia. The only tragedy is that he isn't able to write as much as he should, because he's a brilliant entry writer.
Yeah, he is, yeah, he is.
And he's writing not nearly enough, because he's doing all of this other stuff.
How many people are involved in the encyclopedia at this point?
Well, Peter Nichols is editor emeritus. He has made it very public that his Parkinson's has made it impossible for him to be actively involved. He was the creator of the first edition, essentially, in 1979.
Right.
And for 1979, even earlier than that, when he got the contract going. So he was the senior figure whose health did not allow him to remain a senior figure.
Yeah.
So he is emeritus, there's me, there's David Langford, and there is Graham Slight, who is a friend of ReaderCon, where we are now, but who is basically doing financial management insofar as there are finances to manage. He does the VAT, the accountancy, the tax forms, and oversight, philosophical oversight, as it were. And
performing the hand of sleight.
Yes. Yes.
Sorry.
There are things that do stop a conversation in its tracks.
Yes, yeah, I'm sorry. Freund. Well,
never mind.
And I'm expert
there's another
at them.
Very bad punter named Roger Robinson, an old friend of mine, who has been doing a great deal of the work in maintaining the factual background from which I take data to make entries out of. And he's done a lot of the mechanical and publishing stuff, not ever wanting to be acknowledged at all, but he is actually a very central figure. And I'm getting him involved in some of the enormously complicated but easy to understand once you see it on the page job of keeping various aspects of it up to date.
Mm-hmm.
So that's basically all there is, except for other people who have done work mostly for free.
Yeah.
Adam Roberts, the author and academic, have written something like 45,000 words of music entries. He sort of telephoned and said, would you like music entries? I said, David said, yes. Mm-hmm. And within weeks, it seemed, there was a short book worth of them. We've had enormous luck. And Jonathan Clements, a friend who is Englishman, who is also who is fluent in both main languages of China and Japan and translates from them, has done 120 entries on Far Eastern authors, none of whom could have been written about because almost all of them were only in the original languages, and he has given us long English language entries about people who have not been translated yet.
Yeah.
With proper bibliographies. And that's part of the whole endeavor of the modern encyclopedia of science fiction, which is now a kind of a world encyclopedia in the making. We'll probably be dead before it gets there, but its remit is necessarily expanding more and more so that it doesn't retain any sense that it is an unwitting accomplice of first world philosophies.
Yeah, had he not died tragically, I'd like to think that Douglas Adams would have gotten involved for the hitchhiker's aspect.
Oh, he's certainly involved, as he's certainly an entry on.
Oh, absolutely, of course.
But he didn't like deadlines and things. I doubt he would ever have done entries for us. It's very hard.
No, but grand thinking about forms.
Grand thinking
and stuff.
That would have been good. There are various people who have really great ideas and who have given us occasional entries. The problem is that most people who know a lot are shit bad at writing entries.
Mm-hmm.
It's not intuitive. It is absolutely learnable, which is what makes me so frustrated with academics, because academics, as a rule, cannot learn to do the kind of protocols that we demand. The protocols we demand being based on starting with the actual date and location of a particular text and building from there is non-compliant with the way they are taught to use the literatures that they study. They're basically atemporal, abstract, extractive, MLA compliant texts tend to look like series of what you would call links, not links, no, there's another term to describe. They're not citations, findings.
Oh, okay.
I think the word is findings. The reference structure is a structure of findings. In other words, it's not what somebody thought. It is something objective which has been extracted, which can be referred to, as though you were writing a sociological report or a report in some kind of soft science. And that kind of thing, they cannot seem to get their heads around caring diddly squat about the original date of a book.
Right.
Because what they have is a cataloging system and an intellectual system and a protocol for writing system which devalues attention being paid to that sort of aspect.
Mm-hmm.
And in Fantastica, the term I've been using for several years to describe the whole feeling of field of non-realistic but real literature of the 21st century and earlier, for Fantastica, it is absolutely essential to know where and when. You've got to start.
With context.
You've got to start. You cannot recognize unless you know when or where or how or who you recognize.
That's how I started this interview.
And I think that, tragically, most of the academic literature that I run across is what you might a series of evasions from recognition.
Mm-hmm.
Strategies that allow almost anything, and some of it's valuable, but almost anything but actual raw recognition of what actually happened in a particular story when it happened, in terms of when it was written and when it's meant to be set.
Right.
And the encyclopedia is designed not necessarily to tell all those stories, but not to disenable the user from a sense that that story is being told in that book.
Mm-hmm.
So it is hard to get contributors. Someone like Jonathan Clements, instinctive. He knew exactly what to do. Somebody like X took three times as much to rewrite his or her copy as it did to write the piece in the first place.
Yeah.
It's very, very difficult. In any case, we came online 2011. There were, I think it was 3,200,000 words. We've now hit 5 million words, and I myself have written well over 2 million of them.
Yeah.
So I've been very busy.
Yeah. So it's pretty, well, obviously, very time-consuming. Does that take away?
Very time-absorbing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it absorbs time. It doesn't consume it. Consuming time sounds like something I'm going to lose the prestige out of.
Yes, there you go. And how do you monetize this?
Oh, that's a secret.
Yeah. Same for me in radio, but I've got two words for that. I don't. But
we're paid a stipend by Galantz.
Okay.
Which is based on their sense of the value of the throughput of the of material of descriptions from the checklists, which have about 60,000 titles now, into their own gateway, because any book that they are monitoring or selling or mentoring, if you hit the title in our checklist, you would go to their gateway.
Okay.
Which is outside the encyclopedia. It's not an advertisement for the gateway, but it's just if you hit the thing, you get linked there. When you get linked there, you can leave. So that's useful to them. And it's also useful to Galantz, I think, to have the shared honor. We share the honor of being there, and they share the honor of housing us. They don't...
Yeah.
Publish us quite. They don't not publish. That's one of the reasons the contracts are so complicated.
Yes,
the short contract we have, my agent and I think the Galantz people said, there's hardly a clause in here that we recognize from previous boilerplate.
Right.
So it is a very complex relationship and a very. I think it's a good and healthy relationship with Galantz.
Yeah.
And I think they think so too, because we're now fourth, fifth year, and we are continuing quite happily.
We can.
One of the modern things that is happening to this interview at the moment is that
the phone is ringing
that I bought yesterday is telling me something which I don't understand, and so I am going to put that away somewhere.
Oh, okay.
And that was interesting. But we must be running through our time anyway.
We've got about 5 to 10 minutes okay. left. So getting into the time absorption of it,
yeah.
You're writing not lots of fiction.
No, I'm not really writing any fiction at all. Now, fiction has never been a central preoccupation. It was central when I wrote individual pieces of fiction.
Right.
I became obsessively engaged in writing the novel Appleseed, which... came out after our last interview, but it's a long time ago, 2001.
Yeah,
which is a very intense space opera.
I loved it.
I'm myself I remain very, very happy with it. And I realized after I did it that I would have to change my life utterly to be able to do something like that again.
Yeah.
And I wasn't willing to. I blew my wad. I blew the wad of the life I was leading. And I was, no way was I about to plunge into that fervor, that madness, as it were, that sustained, controlled madness of a person who spends his or her entire life fundamentally writing fiction. I felt I could write fiction. I felt I did write fiction. I felt that the arguments I'd made before, I published an early novel, but it's with a very weird book, and it's published, but I don't talk about it much. It's called The Disinheriting Party. It's marvelous. It's very easy to find if you... Well, never mind. sort of thing. I knew I could write fiction because I had written bits of fiction and hundreds of poems that I didn't publish as a very young man, as we all do. And then drifted away, and the drift seemed natural to me. And I think a lot of people should, as it were, pay due heed to this kind of complex impulse they may have in their own careers. Because there are quite a few exceedingly good or exceedingly interesting novels written as kind of singletons in careers that had other shapes. And I don't think it's unnatural. Right. I don't think it's unnatural at all. And so that intense 9 months, whatever it was, to write Appleseed was in itself sufficient. But that's not how one describes most authors. They're not writing one book with all their might and main. They're writing a lifetime world of books. And I never thought I would.
And what about your critical work?
I still excuse me. I still write occasional reviews, usually longer, no more than maybe 10 a year. And just finished a review of Katsuo Ishiguro's The Buried Giant, which I thought very, very highly of and got duly enraged about literary traditionalists, I thought, misunderstanding it because they didn't understand Fantastica. They didn't understand that
in the 21st... Still the same old story, though.
In the 21st century...
That they don't.
Yeah, well, it's so simple, folks. As I said at the end of this review, Fantastica in the 21st century is getting what you see.
Yeah.
Just sit there looking at the words. Look at the words, damn you. Look at Gene Wolfe's words, damn you.
Mm-hmm.
Look at Katsuo Ishiguro's words. And then tell me, oh, this is a bunch of clinky medievalism here. This is silly fantasy here. And he's got ogres, and he doesn't know what ogres are, but he does know what ogres are because you read it carefully enough, you'd understand that in terms of the recognition structure of a book written sophisticatedly as a recognition of the world, ogres, as they did when they were invented, are a sign of the moral desuetude of the land. The center does not hold. Ogres haunt the forests. That's what ogres are.
Yeah.
Ogres are not Walt Disney, etc.
Well, with the exception, perhaps, of in Into the Woods, but Disney should have never had that. But
the first half of Into the Woods.
The latter half is.
You
well.
Think so?
Yeah, very much so. I've seen many productions of the play.
That
and I know
not.
What's in there that and what's not, yeah. in the movie.
Yeah.
And the play is so much based on Bruno Bettelheim.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
He really does. That's where they get their concept of they use the word giant.
Yeah.
So in that sense, in the Bruno Bettelheim Freudian sense of what an ogre does, and mm-hmm. yes, does destroy that world, does it, it is the ogre stomping on the village
right.
that brings that dark second act about.
Okay.
So I do.
But,
so,
but the fact that that's very convincing. Yes. Okay,
but,
that's right.
But,
yeah.
But the fact that that's a Disney movie.
Maybe, but that's not a Disney movie.
It really isn't.
You know, when we, the Disney Corporation is capable of doing many things under its vast umbrella of bits of the world.
But thanks be that they mostly left it to the director.
Sure.
To do
sure.
his interpretation sure. of the play. So,
yeah. I think possibly what bothered me in the second half of the movie was what bothers me in every Sondheim production I've ever listened to. It's when he gets serious about love. I can't
okay.
stand chest voice.
Okay. I'm a huge Sondheim fan, but I will acknowledge
that's my only demur.
That issue. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
You just hear the smell, the stink of Broadway.
So
never mind.
There you go. Except when he writes opera. Well, Passion is actually quite good about that, and that's
yes.
certainly about
Passion.
Love.
I think one might exclude, and Assassins, of course.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Now,
but generally speaking, there are those heart-stopping moments where middle-aged men and women in from Scarborough are going to feel that they have had their money's worth.
I'm a New Yorker, but
right.
Oh, this is my snarky answer for that. What are you doing that's new that we can tell people about?
Basically, I think nothing much except doing more of the same, except I've begun to write extended entries on individual films in the encyclopedia.
Aha.
Which have always been, film entries have always been more editorial, more like reviews than the rest of the encyclopedia. For good reasons. We're talking about, one's talking about an individual piece of art rather than an author or a theme, and users demand it.
Yeah.
Users are not going to be really happy in this particular field of discourse with a value-neutral description. I figure. So I'm increasingly writing entries which are very easy to read as reviews
mm-hmm.
of films, but reviews that are constructed with the link structure in mind and with the encyclopedia as a whole in mind. So they generalize horizontally through the encyclopedia. I just did the last one I did was of Terminator Genesis, and I did. I'm having to be very careful. I may have to cut a little bit when I rework it. It's already up, but I always fiddle around with an entry after I've done it two or three times to get it properly into the saddle. One of the glories of being online.
Yeah.
I'm making an argument in there that, and it's probably been made before, but not in the encyclopedia, that the terrible moral decrepitude of the PG-13 classification,
mm-hmm.
which allows, of course, all sorts of violence as long as you don't see blood, all sorts of prurience as long as you don't see tits, etc., 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 and young adult values so that the family is always overvalued against any kind of, as it were, voluntary association, etc., etc., etc. You know, this I'm just rattling on, but that combined with PGI means that what in a pre-PGI world would just be an absence of good taste and good morals now becomes genocide, obscenity. Because with PGI you can destroy an entire city without any loss of blood and adhering to the PG-13 criteria.
Yes.
And I think that is a valuable thing to pound heads on, that with PGI, instead of brutalizing a grocery store, you can commit genocide.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, but I think that they get more brutal and stuff. I am proudly squeamish, I do not watch Game of Thrones because...
I've never actually watched Game of Thrones, although obviously some of the high points are of great interest to any man. But I've never watched it. But PGI stroke CGI, PG-13, sorry, stroke PGI, is a really, really deadly set, generates lessons like Terminator Genesis,
yeah,
in which there is an almost constant destruction of life, although you don't see the life being destroyed.
Yeah.
Or you don't see the lives being destroyed.
Yeah, but that goes back to James Bond, for that matter.
That was an atrocity. It wasn't genocide.
Okay.
Okay? It's a spectrum I'm talking here.
Yeah.
I'm talking spectrum, man.
So many, many, many years ago when we were first having these conversations, yeah, I asked you, and I don't know that I have the wherewithal now, but I had always wondered about the place for radio and the history of audio in the encyclopedia.
Did I ask you if you wanted to write some entries?
Yeah, I was referred to somebody else who never got back to me.
Oh, well, we can begin that conversation again. We do have a moderately good, because it was written by an Australian, so it doesn't cover America very well. There is a good global entry on radio.
Yes.
But there is a vast amount of radio I would love to get covered.
Yeah.
And this is the kind of it's good to have a conversation on this like this on record so I can humiliate you over the years for non-delivery. I would love to have an array of entries enfiladed into the encyclopedia that subtend from and reconstruct the existing radio entry, which has a few ancillary entries. I would love to see that. That's part of the...
I'm not an expert in old radio, but I know
when you have the encyclopedia, what we do is we drop pebbles into the pool, and the pebbles connect, and other pebbles get dropped, and the links connect them all.
Yeah.
So it doesn't... We don't have to have everything at once.
And when you include podcasts and audiobooks and the like, there is more now than there ever has been.
Of course there has been. And some people... Mike Ashley has been doing... I did a lot of magazine entries a year or so ago, and some of them were podcasts, etc., and he's maintaining a sense of what to do. So we have a reasonable amount of coverage. It's just, you know, manpower is necessary. There's very little that I would think was not appropriate. We just went over the 16,000 entry mark. An individual entry is not going to do more than in... It may be a stupid entry, but it'll enrich a little bit. But it's not going to poison.
Yeah.
Or an irrelevant entry just won't be linked to. People won't notice it's there.
So it is just about time for us to start wrapping up now.
Yep.
So closing thoughts.
Oh, we've been having them for a long time. We've been talking about the end of the world. We've been talking about genocide. We've been talking about an encyclopedia that nobody knows how to monetize, except we somehow magically stay alive.
Yes.
And we've talked about this and that.
And the prestige of civilization. And
the prestige, which is disappearing every time we push a button.
Exactly.
Every time we become a barcode. I think that's really the ultimate message is that, but the thing I wrote for the prose thing that we do tonight, you know, you write a little phrase.
Yes. Yes.
And I compressed a thought about our dreams of agency are as it were illusory. Agency is fodder.
Yeah. And I will.
That's where I stop. You can't continue.
Yes.
That was my punchline.
But I've got another one.
Okay.
Which ends with the thing that is on my sticker for tonight that says, next week, same time, same station.
I'll be there.
And indeed, you've been listening to an interview with John Clute, C-L-U-T-E, who is the editor of the Encyclopedia of Science Fiction, which you can find online. And as announced this week is, well, the donor of what is now the Clute Science Fiction Library at Telluride. This guy has one of the most amazing collections of science fiction books, to the point where I mentioned during the interview that I've seen him any number of times on TV. And that's because he could go down to his library, I believe his basement, you know, temperature controlled basement, and pull out almost any major science fiction volume. And that is now going to be residing at Telluride, where he will also be holding an annual event. So, this has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you so much for listening. I will be back next week from 1:30 all the way to 5, I believe, because I believe as of next week, Burn Baby Burn Clapper goes on vacation for 2 weeks, and I have a lot of interviews that I'm going to be catching up on. It's next week, right, Lister? Okay, so stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper, which is coming your way. It's the last time you'll hear it for 2 weeks, which if it were a thon coming up, it'd be the last time you'd hear it for, well, who knows how long. At any rate, thank you for listening. Please, everybody, be good to each other. Join our group on Facebook, Hour of the Wolf, or go to ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF. Don't forget, September 8th, here at 388 Atlantic Avenue, Michael Swanwick and Rajan Khanna will be performing at what will be the beginning of the 25th anniversary of the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. It will be fun. Admission is free. Donations hoped for in so many ways. Again, have a good week. And if you want to write me, oh yeah, jim@ourwolf.com. Good morning. Take care. Oh yeah, I know I should have outroed John with a little Sondheim, but, well, there you go.
Cause my heart is internal. The American dream. upon me, but you want me in prison, cause I'm busy attacking the flag. I rag it and snag it and drag it and rip it to shreds, cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy, so just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece up to ashes, cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
play our dreams real by the mean. And now don't you turn your lovely soul into grain. Don't you dare.